This episode comes with a trigger warning. It discusses research into suicidal thoughts experienced by parent carers. The content may be distressing or triggering for some listeners. Please take care while listening and reach out to a support network if needed. Hello and welcome to Care Fully Considered, the podcast about caring, the issues unpaid carers face and how we solve them. I'm Katie, an unpaid carer and the founder of the We Care campaign, grassroots organisation empowering unpaid carers to feel visible and valued.
And I'm Laura, also an unpaid carer, and we're here to inform and hopefully entertain you. Each episode, we'll be talking to an expert to get their views and see what we can all do to get the change millions of carers across the UK need. Right, Katie, let's get cracking. How are you? What's been happening in your world?
Well, the guinea pigs that I've been looking after have been very good and I returned them today. So that's quite a relief because looking after six individuals, you know, three of them guinea pigs, I have to add, is quite hard work, I have to say. And then in WeCare world, I'm writing a timeline, a history timeline of WeCare to go into a project for carers in Chile. So that's quite something, isn't it?
Wow, you've gone international. You're always doing something cool. Last time it was B-roll filming and now you're doing something for Chileans. It's amazing. Well done, powerhouse. Shall we introduce our first guest?
I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Siobhan O'Dwyer to the podcast. She is Associate Professor in Adult Social Care at the University of Birmingham. Her latest research looks into suicidal thoughts and behaviours in parent carers.
It's a really important topic, actually, and the research that I read was just shocking, really. Welcome to the podcast, Siobhan. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Katie, I had just added to my watch list a new documentary about guinea pigs that's on Netflix. So that's a lovely little moment of shared interest.
Oh, one of my favourite videos is Guinea Pig Olympics. So that sort of goes with the summer. I will share it and we'll put it at the bottom of the pod because it is just something to die for. They are jumping through hoops and going through sticks. It's wonderful.
That's awesome.
Right then, let's get to the basics, Siobhan. How would you introduce yourself to a stranger sitting next to you at a dinner party, or I think maybe in your case, an Aussie Barbie?
I probably wouldn't. I'm an introvert. I don't go to a lot of dinner parties. I'd much rather be at home with my cat and a cup of tea and a good book. But on the odd occasion that I am forced to leave the house and interact with other people, I usually just start by saying, Hi, I'm Siobhan, and that's all that happens, because immediately someone either says, how do you spell that, or is that an accent? And then that's where the conversation goes. So I usually don't have to do very much other than say my name.
All right then, so we've discovered that you are an Australian and that you do some research on social care. Could you talk us a little bit through then how you came to do what you do? Did you always have an interest in social care? How does one become a researcher?
So I did an undergraduate degree in psychology, and at the end of my degree, I fully expected that I was going to be a clinician, but I wanted to take a year off before I did my clinical training. In that year, my grandfather became really unwell. He was in his 90s and he was no longer able to live independently. So I moved in with him and started looking after him. And alongside that, I was also working part-time as a research assistant and discovered that I loved this research stuff. And so I never went back to my clinical training. I did a PhD. And because I had this really close relationship with my grandfather, my PhD was all around health and aging. And then after I finished my PhD, I spent a couple of years working for a not-for-profit, so sort of the Australian equivalent of Age UK. And then I moved back into an academic career, did a couple of postdoctoral research fellowships. And for one of those, I had the opportunity to do some research on carers. And that was the moment when I discovered that that's what I had been, that there was a name for this thing that I was doing, which I think is a really common experience for lots of carers. Yeah. And I became hooked on research around carers and doing research in a space that it felt like there were not that many people doing research, and that there was real scope to do research that could inform practice and policy. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 15 years or so. All of my research has been focused on unpaid carers.
There's an awful lot of a crossover there with what Laura's doing, isn't there? You know, you both moved in to support grandparents, so I could see her smiling away when you mentioned that. For those who don't know, Siobhan, how would you officially define parent carers?
Oh, that's a really good question. So a parent carer is someone who has a child with a long-term illness or a disability. So they are a parent. The reason we add the carer is because what they're doing is above and beyond what a parent for a same age child without a disability would be doing. So it's not just parenting, say, a six-year-old, it's parenting a six-year-old with autism or with Down syndrome. And so the carer is the bit that goes on top. So that's how we distinguish a parent from a parent carer.
And why did you decide to sort of focus on this particular group of people for the research that we're talking about today? What was it about them that you thought you'd focus on?
So we'd done some research in Australia, maybe sort of 10 years ago, a little bit less than that, around people caring for family members with dementia. And we found that about 16% of them had thought about ending their lives, so they thought about suicide while they were caring, which was quite a high number. But I had this hunch that it might be different in other groups of carers, because caring for a person with dementia, although it's incredibly hard, it's time limited. You know, maybe it's 5 years, 10 years at the outside. There's also really socially acceptable ways of ending that caring role. You can move the person into a care home, into a nursing home. But for parent carers, this is a lifelong role from the day your child is born to the day your child dies, or you die if you go first. And there are very few ways for relinquishing that caring role. It's really socially unacceptable as a parent to say, I can't do this. So my hunch was that the numbers might be even higher in parent carers. But not having had a lot of experience with parent carers, I thought maybe I should just ask some before I embark on this research, just make sure I'm on the right track. So we had a meeting with a bunch of parent carers in Devon and said, look, we've got this idea. What do you think? Is this even an issue? And they all said, yes, absolutely. This is a massive issue. No one talks about it. We really want to be able to talk about it. And so that was where the research began. What we did at that point, though, was we also included four of the parent carers who'd been at that meeting as co-researchers. So they've been on the team from that point all the way through, from getting the funding, designing the study, recruiting parents, doing the data analysis, writing up the findings. Their voices and their experiences are really at the heart of this. And so it was very much driven by their lived experience and what they wanted to see come out of this research.
I think having that lived experience there from the very start is what makes this research so special, but also knowing that they've been involved for that amount of time when they've been doing the parent caring and giving you that time shows how important it is to them as well, isn't it? I mean, yeah. that's really vital.
Absolutely. They've been so committed to this, and the things that I've learned from them about what it means to be a parent carer, what the impact is, you know, how do we invite parent carers to be part of research? How do we, you know, get them to trust us that we're going to handle their experiences responsibly, that something will actually come out of this research and it won't just sit on a shelf. They've been so dedicated. And as you say, Katie, they've been caring this whole time as well. And I think some of them had been involved in research before and they were a bit skeptical. One of the carers said a year or so ago, she came to that very first meeting and thought she would tell her story and then she'd never hear from us ever again. And she said, you know, 5 or 6 years later, I'm still here. And that, you know, you could take that in quite a bad way. It's a little bit Hotel California, isn't it? But she meant it in a good way that, you know, we really did make that commitment to them and they made that commitment to us. And it really has made the research so much better than it could ever have been without them.
We'll just say now that we're hoping to interview one of the carers themselves as well later for a little mini podcast. So what is your aim for this research? What do you hope to achieve with it?
At the outset, it was about understanding, were thoughts of suicide something that parent carers experienced? How many of them experienced these thoughts? What were the risk factors? So what makes it more likely that a parent carer will think about this? Are there any protective factors? And then really thinking about what do we do with that information? Once we have that information, what needs to change in policy and practice to support parent carers who are feeling this way? So that was really our goal with this research.
You've mentioned a lot around sort of even the parent carers saying that nobody talks about it, that, you know, it doesn't seem to be spoken about much, even within, I guess, carer circles or social care circles. But yet, more than 800,000 children in the UK have disabilities and long-term illnesses, and the majority of them are cared for by their parent. What I was shocked by reading it was that yours is the first study of its kind in the UK. And so, I guess from your experience of interviewing parent carers, why do you think that is? Is it because people don't think about it? Is it because they get lumped in with parents or they get lumped in with carers? Why is that population sort of ignored, well, up until now, really?
I think specifically in the context of asking parent carers about suicide and doing research on that topic, I think as human beings, we really struggle to hold two competing ideas in our head at the same time. So people really struggle with that idea that you can love your child and you can want the best for your child and be fully committed to caring for them and be so overwhelmed that you want to think about it. You know, you're thinking about ending your own life. I think people really struggle with that idea. I also think we, as a society, tend to romanticize caring and say that, oh, carers are just these amazing altruistic people just with unlimited amounts of love and they will just keep going no matter what. And it's not true. Yes, there is love, and yes, that's fantastic, and people are devoted. But love doesn't mitigate all the crap. Sorry, that's the only word I can think of. All the crap that carers go through. And so I think that's why people haven't asked, researchers haven't asked in the past, because we had this sort of myth that carers couldn't possibly think about ending their own lives because they were so dedicated to the person they were caring for. But it's possible to be both.
Where do you think that comes from, Siobhan? I mean, is that a societal thing? Is it because that's how politicians talk about us?
I think so. I think it's absolutely a policy thing. You know, we often hear policymakers and even some of the big charities talk about carers and their loved ones. And I think that's such a dangerous way to talk about people. Firstly, because they're not all loved. I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge. But also love is not enough. You know, love will not get you through when there is no other support, when you're living in poverty, when you can't get your child an EHCP, an educational healthcare plan. Love isn't enough to survive this stuff unscathed. But I think it's a very effective policy language for policymakers to get out of fully supporting carers and the people they care for.
Let's come and look to some of the results that you've uncovered. Shockingly, you found that 42% of parent carers have experienced suicidal thoughts while caring for their disabled children. And reading through the research, you surveyed, you know, 750 parent carers. So I mean, it's a big sample. It's not like you had a small sample. So there's, you know, just under half, isn't it, have felt like this. Can you explain why this is, do you think? Can we pick through that a little bit, Siobhan?
Sure. So I think what's important to acknowledge, first of all, is that those numbers are off the charts in terms of other groups of carers. So other groups of carers contemplate suicide at much higher rates than the general population, but parent carers are well above that. And the figures we see in parent carers are very close to the sort of numbers we would see in asylum seekers or military veterans who've experienced, you know, face-to-face sort of combat and those sorts of experiences. And I think what parent carers have in common with asylum seekers and military veterans is long-term trauma and exposure to really difficult circumstances over a really long period of time. And so it is that being a parent carer is a long-term experience. It's a lifetime experience. There is no way out of this. And I think in the UK, those experiences are compounded by more than a decade of austerity. So there are no sources of support for parent carers. What's available for their kids is getting smaller and smaller as time goes on. So I think that's what's really driving these numbers of 42% of parent carers thinking about suicide.
It's shocking it's those figures, but for any carer, it's totally understandable, I think, because we recognise the pressures that that group are particularly under, and the pressures from austerity and from COVID and the lack of support and the fact that it's not coming back. So yeah, it is shocking, but to us it isn't, which is awful in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. These numbers are not shocking to carers. And actually when we were doing the research and I was doing the data analysis, I ran the stats, the number came out, I had a little cry, and then I thought, that can't possibly be right. And so I ran the stats again and the number came out the same and I cried some more. And then I thought, gosh, how do I tell these four carers who've been part of the research? I don't want this to be triggering for them. I don't want this to be really distressing for them. And I spent hours crafting a very carefully worded email, and they all came back immediately and said, yeah, that's about what we thought it would be. So they weren't shocked at all. But I think the feeling very much for us as a research team is not one of shock, but one of anger. That, you know, so many parent carers have been walking around feeling like this, no one has known, and there's nothing in the system at the moment that's going to support those carers. And so even though we have this figure now, this is just the start of a long journey to think about how do we actually support parent carers and make it better and start to reduce those numbers.
In reading the report as well, a word came up a lot that I felt was interesting. It was the word entrapment. Why would parents in this research use that word? Do they feel trapped? Because it has a malicious connotation. So is it trapped in a system, or is it trapped in the fact that they can't seem, you know, there's no way to get out of their situation? I wonder what you think about that.
Sure. Yeah. So people do often use that word entrapment in a malicious way. We think about, you know, police officers, you know, entrapping a bad guy, or we think about that dreadful Catherine Zeta-Jones, Sean Connery movie. In the context of suicide research, sorry.
What a reference.
That's what I think of when I hear the word entrapment. Yeah. But in the context of suicide, it and theories about suicide, it has a very specific meaning about feeling trapped in your life circumstances to the point that suicide feels like the only way out. So it's not a word that parent carers are actually using to describe their experience. It's sort of the academic word that we put on that. But carers do talk about feeling trapped in the caring role, not having a way out. And it's linked very much to that being trapped in a system too, that they is constantly against them, is constantly against their kids. No matter what they do, they're always having to fight, they're always having to battle, and things often don't get better as a result. So yeah, parent carers talk very much about feeling trapped in the role, and it is one of the big risk factors that come out for suicidal thoughts. So if parent carers are feeling trapped, that increases the likelihood that they will be thinking about suicide.
Is it also something around, you know, when Ed Davey was campaigning, you know, he talked about him, you know, his caring situation, him being a parent carer. There's also a lot of worry that comes with it, in the sense that what happens to their child when they're not around anymore. Do you think that anxiety about the future, and again, because there is no help available, do you think that would increase the sense of anxiety, which then leads to depression, which then leads to these types of thoughts? I wonder if there's anything in the research that revealed that to some extent.
Absolutely. And so this particular study, just for logistical reasons, we had to limit it to parents of kids who were under 18. But we know that these experiences are not unique to parents of underage children with disabilities. These are also thoughts experienced by parents of adult children. And in some cases, actually, things get worse when your children age out of the children's sector and suddenly are facing this adult sector. And so we do know that's a particular challenge. We also know that for all carers, including parent carers, if you feel so trapped that you can't act on your suicidal thoughts, this also brings up for some carers thoughts of homicide, so thoughts of ending the life of their child, because the feeling is very much one of, well, if I kill myself, my child is going to be left without any care, and carers know from years of experience that no one will care for their child. And so the feeling is we will go together. And that's particularly common in older parents who are seeing, you know, disabled kids in their 30s, 40s and 50s and saying, I'm not going to be around much longer. Who's going to take care of my child? And so those thoughts of a homicide, suicide become very real.
We collect data on that, do we, Siobhan, nationally or not?
No.
I mean, does it always show up or not.
So we've done some research recently, a separate piece of research around homicides that have involved carers, and we found that there's about 13 a year in England and Wales. But that's us looking at media reports, court documents, those sorts of things. There is no routine data collection either on suicides or on homicides around caring status. And it's really important because often what happens in terms of policy, and particularly policy around suicide prevention, is it's based very much on the number of deaths. That's when we consider a group to be at high risk, when they have high rates of death. But we don't have that data for carers, and we certainly don't have it for parent carers. So we're saying, look, they're a high-risk group because 42% have thought about killing themselves. But actually, until we have that death data, my fear is that policymakers won't take this research seriously. But from my perspective, why on earth are we waiting for people to die before we act? And even if carers aren't acting on these thoughts, the fact that they're experiencing these suicidal thoughts means that they're in high levels of distress and they desperately need support. So I don't think we should be waiting. I think we need to be acting now, but it is certainly out of this research and our previous studies, a recommendation for policy is we need routine data collection on carers, on caring status when someone dies by suicide or when there's a homicide.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Why are we waiting? But also, yeah, the trauma that you're internalising because you're not actually acting that out must be horrendous. Yeah. So, yeah, totally agree. More than half of parent carers have felt life was not worth living, quoting from your document, and half have wished that they were dead and away from it all. I think, as we've said throughout this podcast, you know, unpaid carers can relate to that feeling of total overwhelm. There isn't a carer that wouldn't, and that hopelessness and just seeing your days as groundhog days that just begin and end exactly the same, but perhaps even get worse each time. So what needs to happen to get parent carers and other carers the help they clearly desperately need? And if we could start diagnostically and medically.
Sure. So that's a really difficult place, the clinical and sort of diagnostic approach to this, because we know absolutely that depression is a risk factor for suicidal thoughts in the general population, but also in parent carers. We also know that having a mental illness before you became a carer puts you at greater risk of suicidal thoughts as a carer. But we also know that 54% of people who thought about suicide didn't have a pre-existing mental illness, and 31% of parent carers who thought about suicide didn't have a current physical or mental illness. So it's really important that we don't make the assumption that all parent carers who are thinking about suicide are depressed. And for carers who are, absolutely, therapy, medication, those things are fantastic. And for a lot of carers, they will be, it's what they need to get to a place where they can cope with what's going on in their lives. So I'm a big advocate of those things. But it's really important that we don't just do those things, that we don't just offer parent carers medication or therapy, because that doesn't get to the bigger issues that are underlying why carers are depressed in the first place, why a caring role exacerbates an existing mental illness. So I think there's absolutely a space for things like antidepressants and counselling, talking therapies, but we also have to do the social fixes as well. And you asked, Katie, you asked about diagnostics as well, and I think this is a really important point. So more than 50% of the parent carers in our study said they had never told anyone that they were feeling suicidal. And of those who had, when we interviewed carers after the big survey, said, you know, I didn't, even when I did feel brave enough to share it, I didn't get any support. Or they referred me for counselling. The counsellor didn't understand my situation, and so nothing changed. And we also know that in things like carers assessments and other sort of frontline services, no one is asking carers about suicidal thoughts. So that's sort of a recommendation here as well, that we need to get to a place where we're routinely asking all carers, and particularly parent carers, if they're thinking about suicide. That should be a routine question as far as I'm concerned.
What do you think needs to be done sort of policy-wise and even societally to help parent carers?
Yeah, and I think with parent carers, around that sort of lack of support, it's about recognizing that it's a double whammy for parent carers. It's not just that they're not being supported as a carer, it's that their child is not being supported. You know, they can't get their kids the educational support they need. They can't get them the healthcare they need. And often for a lot of parent carers that we speak to through the research, say, look, I could do this. I'd be okay without the support if my child was getting the support they needed. So much of the challenge and the impact on parent carers is that constantly having to battle for support, not being believed that their child has an illness or a disability, you know, for years before they get the diagnosis, not being able to get an educational healthcare plan, not being able to get into special schools. So I think it's that double whammy for parent carers of no caring support, but also no support for their kids. In terms of policy and social stuff, I guess my trite answer is, how long have we got? You know, the list of things in policy and clinical practice that need to be fixed is, you know, as long as my arm. But I think probably the key thing is that not making carers have to fight for everything, not making parent carers have to battle for every little bit of support that they get for their kids, and not making them have to re-fight those battles. So for a lot of parent carers we see, they fight a battle, they get their child something they need, and then in a year's time or 2 years' time, the government says, well, no, we need proof still that your child is disabled, so we want you to fight all of those battles again. Or that transition from, you know, primary school to high school or childhood to adulthood, those re-fighting those battles, being forced to prove that their child needs support. And we hear this a lot from parent carers who say, in order to get my child support, I have to present the worst version of them. You know, there's no space in this system to say that my child is amazing, my child is a really talented artist, my child is a great musician, my child is kind. It's all about how awful their child is and how disabled their child is in order to get that support. And that's heartbreaking, that parents don't get to celebrate their kids. Parent carers don't get to celebrate their kids in the way that other parents do. I think respite care is a massive thing. In 10, nearly 15 years of research, it's the thing I hear in every single study we ever conduct with carers, is they just need a break. And a break that doesn't make things worse. So a break where their child or the person they're caring for is supported by qualified professionals who know what to do. And certainly one of the parent carers who was involved in our research said, you know, it was almost impossible to find a babysitter for her child. And even when she did, often she would come home and the situation was so bad that it negated any benefits she got from having a break. So I think respite care is huge. And I think at a bigger policy level, there's also a need for recognising carers in some of our national strategies. So we have a national strategy for suicide prevention. Carers are nowhere to be seen in that strategy. There is a brief mention of them, but it's in their capacity as someone caring for a family member who is thinking about suicide. There's no mention of carers in their own right as a risk group. And obviously, as I'm sure you've probably talked about on the podcast before, we don't have a national carers strategy. So that would be a first step. And then I would love to see, you know, suicide and homicide risk somewhere in that national carers strategy. So that those are kind of my top picks. But obviously there's a huge amount more that needs to be done to support carers as a group, but also parent carers in particular.
Was it 30% of the parent carers were also looking after another family member? Or friends in your, yeah. So, I mean, we've got to factor that in as well, because that's an incredible amount of work, isn't it? Not only have you got a child that needs extra support, and then you're looking after, you know, a partner or a parent or a parent's partner or a neighbour or whatever it is on top. That's just mind-blowing.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are plenty of parents who have more than one child with a disability. Lots of people, who are, you know, particularly middle-aged women who are caring for disabled children, perhaps caring for a parent with a long-term illness or disability, maybe dementia. Then you throw in the added whammy for those middle-aged women of menopause. You know, it's a perfect storm, and it's not surprising that some of those carers reach that point of thinking about ending their lives. It's not surprising at all.
Okay, so what would you say to parent carers that are listening right now that are currently struggling? Is there something that you can say to them, Siobhan?
I think the most important thing is to recognise that you're not the only one. I think before we did this research, so many parent carers who were thinking about suicide thought it was just them. They thought that they were weak, that they were failing as a parent if they were feeling this way. And that 42%, you know, if 42% of parent carers are thinking about ending their own lives, it can't just be you. It's not you failing. It's not you being crazy. It is a horrific experience, not because of your child. This is never about the child. It's about the system that you're in, and a broken system that is making it almost impossible for you to care for your child. So that would be my number one message, is you are not the only one. You are not failing as a parent. You are not crazy. This is a very normal reaction to a very abnormal situation and a very extreme situation. I think the second thing I'd say is there is help. So particularly an organization like the Samaritans, if you're really in crisis, call the Samaritans. Just having that space to safely offload what you're thinking about and what you're feeling can be hugely beneficial. So the number for the Samaritans is 116123. It breaks my heart that there's not much more I can offer than that, because as we've already talked about, there aren't a lot of support services for parent carers. We know that the services just aren't there. But I think knowing that you're not alone and knowing that there are those 24-hour services that you can call is, I hope, something and of some comfort to carers.
Finally, I think to end on a personal note, talking to you, although you are delightful, makes me angry because of the research that you've highlighted and the just complete abandonment of parent carers and unpaid carers in general. How do you handle the subject that you research? Do you do anything just to sort of, because it must be quite heavy for you personally, how do you handle, I guess, the impact that it could have on you?
Yeah, it is really heavy. I went to an art gallery in Sweden a few years ago. It was a modern art gallery, and there was this piece of art that was sort of a metal frame, a metal box, and it was covered in those sort of plastic strip curtains that you get if you go into a butcher's or a fishmonger. But they were all covered in some sort of grease, so, you know, coconut oil or animal fat or something. And the sign for the artwork said, the work is sticky, enter at your own risk. And so you were encouraged to go in, but in the full knowledge that you would get covered in this stuff. And that for me often feels like a really powerful metaphor for the sort of research that I do. It is sticky, it is hard, it gets under your skin, it gets into your soul. But you know that going in, and you commit to it because, you know, you're passionate about this topic. You believe that the work needs to be done. You believe that there's a gap here in terms of policy and practice, and that you might be able to help fill that gap by providing some evidence. So that's the main thing, is being committed to it and knowing that it's a real privilege as a researcher to be trusted with people's stories, and that then I have a responsibility to do something with that and to use that to advocate for people. So often the way I think about it is, it's not about me. You know, it's not actually about what I feel in this situation. My responsibility here is being an advocate. But that said, there are days when I don't want to do this anymore. Why am I not doing research around puppies or butterflies or something lovely?
Guinea pigs.
So on those days, I'm sure people who do research on puppies find their research very incredibly distressing too. But I have this fantasy of doing research on puppies. But on those days when I'm really struggling, there's a few things. One is, it's about having an amazing team. So all of our research is done in teams, and it's a lovely group of people, including the parent carers, who I can go to and say, oh, I'm really struggling. Can you take this load today? Or I just need a hug or whatever. So working with amazing teams. I swim. That's the other thing for me. I swim 4 or 5 days a week. And that for me really gets me out of my head and into my body. I see a psychologist when I need to. I practice what I preach there about asking for help when I don't have the skills to manage stuff. And that all sounds incredibly functional, but I also do some dysfunctional stuff as well. I do my fair share of comfort eating. I recently got hooked on Married at First Sight Australia. I'm not proud. I am deeply, deeply ashamed of that. But in a time when we were doing really difficult work and sharing really difficult stories, it was just something so removed from my experience and so light and frothy that it enabled me to, you know, to just get out of this space. But But at the end of the day, it's coming back to that thing of it's not about me. And this is an absolute privilege to be able to represent carers and advocate on their behalf and do research about their lives. So, you know, that's the thing that keeps me going.
I think I feel similarly in terms of how, you know, running WeCare, we don't want to shy away from the things that are affecting carers. And this is a big thing. And so, of course, we'll have to, you know, talk about it and do as much advocacy as we possibly can and share those stories again. So, yeah, it's so important. And I can't understand why others in the space just aren't. So it's, yeah, it's very important that we do this all together and know that we're together.
And I think that's a really important point, Katie. We see lots of the big carer charities not wanting to engage with this research and not wanting to talk about things like suicide because it's so sensitive. But from my perspective, it doesn't get any less sensitive if we don't talk about it. The way to get rid of the taboo and the stigma and make it safe for people to talk about is by talking about it and acknowledging that this is part of life, it's part of the caring experience. That's how we make that step forward to getting people support. But if we never engage with it, we're never going to solve this problem. And I think we also have to be very precise with our language. We often hear big charities or policymakers talking about things like carers being on their knees or carers being at breaking point. But those are really fuzzy sort of euphemisms. And if we use fuzzy words to describe the problem, we get fuzzy solutions. So I think we have to be using like words like suicide, even though they're uncomfortable, even though they're a bit frightening, if we're going to get really targeted, focused solutions to the problem.
Thank you so much for speaking to us today. Where can our listeners go for more information on your research, on you, on Married at First Sight, Australia, anything?
I wouldn't recommend it. I think it was like 34 episodes. And when I counted up how many hours that was of my life in a very short space of time, I was quite horrified. So yeah, not advocating that, but if you do want to watch, it's on the Channel 4 website. In terms of the research, so we have a webpage for this particular project that is parentcarerwellbeing.org. That's the website. In terms of me, the best way to get in touch with me and hear about latest research and policy work and working with clinicians is Twitter. So it's at Siobhan_O'Dwyer, and I'll trust Katie to put that somewhere so you don't have to spell it. It's a little bit awkward to spell, but that's the best place to sort of keep up to date with what we're doing with the research. And we're really keen, obviously, to connect with more carers, but also to connect with policymakers, frontline charities, frontline health and social care professionals, and really support them to use this research to inform their policy and practice. So as a researcher, I have no interest in doing research that sits on a shelf, and I consider it part of my job to be working with people on the front lines, to be doing evidence-based practice. So I'm always really happy to hear from those sorts of organisations and professionals and use what we know to help them improve the work that they do.
Fab. Well, we'll put all the notes in the podcast description. We might even put a link to Married at First Sight Australia for those who haven't watched it, like me. I'm going to have to watch it. And thank you so much to everyone for listening. Please follow, rate and subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts.
We'd love to hear from you, whether it's questions, guest suggestions or anything else. Please email us at wearecarers, which is all one word, @gmail.com. Until next time.